quiet bunch. I, for one, am ready for the cold to quit. Hopefully this is sort of the last blast. So how's it going with the particle physics stuff? That's sort of a lot, right? Strange names. So, right, so the recitation this week may help a little bit, but it touches many issues that we are going to be talking about as we go, so I want you to have seen it, but I'm certainly not expecting everybody to feel super warm and fuzzy about it. It's actually a very frustrating thing to teach because it's very exciting, but it's really hard to get it started or to introduce it in a quick way because it's a lot all at once, and it takes some getting used to and to see how pieces fit together. At any rate, we've sort of pushed all the way into inner space as far as we can go. And what I wanted to do today is to start looking at the large-scale structure of the universe. And that really begins getting into the core of the class, because that's where most of the multiverse ideas are. So to start off, I just wanted to paint the picture historically. I'm not going to add much more depth than Hobson does. I actually think he has a pretty good introduction in chapter one. But just to give you a sense of sort of how things have evolved, and then as we get into the more modern stuff, obviously I'll add a lot more to it and talk in a lot more detail. But in the early days, the Greeks had a pretty solid view of the universe, which actually makes a lot of sense naively. If you go out and you look at the night sky, it seems as if the earth is at the center of things and the heavens are moving around. And the Greeks were big into perfect geometries and things like that. So they had the idea of the heavenly spheres, where you had the earth at the center with the heavenly bodies basically circling the earth, perfect circles, and the stars being very, very far away on a circle way out beyond. So they actually got the distances about right, because you can actually tell distance using something called parallax. If you take a finger and you do this, and you have another one and you do that, and you move your head back and forth, do it. And look at how the two fingers move with respect to the far distant background. The one that's closer moves a lot more just by virtue of the angles. And the one that's far away, I know, you feel like an idiot, right? The one that's far away doesn't move so much against the far distant background. And you can actually do the geometry, and this is a way to actually calculate the distances to objects that are not super, super far. I mean, you can even use it for nearby stars. At any rate, so this was basically the idea way back with the Greeks. And in fact, Aristarchus, back in 300 BC, proposed a sun-centered universe, which obviously is pretty crazy because the Earth is clearly not moving around. I mean, at any rate, so that was rejected. But the sun-centered universe has some actually big problems. Some are sort of subtle, and you actually need a little telescope to see it, which I'll talk about in a minute. But some are a lot less subtle. If you carefully look at the position of Mars against the stars in the background, you actually find that it appears, if the stars are in the far distance background, distant background, and you watch how Mars moves with respect to those stars, it will move like this, and then there'll be a period during the year where it does that. Basically does retrograde motion, they call it. And how that happens is, if you think about the Earth moving and Mars moving with the far distant stars over here, if you think about how these stars look with respect to Mars as Earth moves and moves past Mars, it basically has to do with the fact that you're running this circle faster than you're running that circle. So if you sort of picture, and actually Hobson has a very nice diagram where he shows the position of Earth at, you know, 10 different times and the position of Mars at those 10 different times. And if you picture where Mars is relative to Earth, where the stars are relative to Earth, you can actually visualize that Mars is going to sort of move like that relative to the background. So this is actually a real problem in the picture of the Earth-centered universe, because, oops, went the wrong way. Because if you have everything sitting on these perfect circles, you really don't have a mechanism for that with Earth at the center. I mean, what would cause this sphere to be moving and then all of a sudden go backwards and then go back the other way? So that was a bit bothersome. But Ptolemy in 100 AD came up with a scheme where he added epicycles. See, part of the problem was you need to keep the planets moving on a perfect geometric shape. So this is a circle within a circle, basically. So circles within circles are epicycles. So now the idea is to have Mars moving on a circle that itself has a center moving around this circle. And when you have Mars moving like this, then you can imagine it's fairly easy to give it that epicycle, that retrograde motion. So in order once people started looking very carefully at the motion of the heavenly bodies, it turned out that you could come up with a scheme that actually would describe the positions of the heavenly bodies rather nicely, but it became quite complex. And as the observations got better, it had to become more and more complex with more and more epicycles. And I've forgotten the number, but years later, the number of epicycles and the complexity sort of got to be a bit ridiculous, but it did basically work. Along came Nikolai Copernicus, and I asked you to read this article earlier in the semester. I think it's a fun article to read. It has a number of lessons in it. But near the end of his lifetime, Copernicus published the idea of the sun-centered universe. And the thing is, this wasn't an overnight shift in our thinking, because the observations were not so perfect as to really show that Copernicus's work or idea fit the data a lot better than Kepler. There were actually some mistakes in the data, apparently. And it has some problems. I mean, there's some real unresolved issues. At this time, the idea of gravity wasn't understood. And here you are promoting the Earth from the center out here, and everybody knows that things always sort of sink toward the center. So what is it that's holding everything on Earth if Earth is not at the center of things? So there were a lot of funny issues. If Earth is flying around in whatever, why are we not falling off the Earth? So there's a lot of issues with this. The data was improved. There was also, with the invention of the small telescope, Galileo was able to observe the phases of Venus. And this actually is a pretty big piece of data in support of the sun-centered universe. If you can imagine having Earth at the center here and having Venus moving And the sun is further away from us from Venus, which is well known. So the sun would be moving on a circle out here with Venus moving right here. And if Venus is moving on some epicycle on this circle, then really there's no stage at which you're going to see a full Venus, I guess, is a way to say it. Because Venus never gets that far from the sun. As we know in our picture, the sun's at the center and Venus is moving on this orbit that basically brings it out from the sun a little bit. Sometimes in the morning you can see it, sometimes in the evening you can see it, depending on the time of year. But from the Earth point of view, Venus is always moving sort of along with the sun in this circle. So this is the type of situation you see. And from the point of view of Earth, you're going to only see partial phases of Venus. You'll never see like a full Venus. And yet, if you have the picture with the sun at the center, then the Earth can be over here while Venus comes close to the other side of the sun, and you'll get an almost full Venus. And with a small telescope, you can see this, and you can see how the phases are consistent with this picture, but not so consistent with that picture. So this was an important piece of data. And then a guy named, I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce this, Tycho Brahe, loved telescopes and managed to get one funded and took lots of very high precision measurements of the planetary bodies and made a catalog of the positions of the sun and the moon and the planets that was actually much better than what had been done before. And Johannes Kepler joined to become an apprentice of Tycho shortly before Tycho's death, and effectively got access to his vast catalog of data in doing this. And Johannes Kepler started studying the data very, very carefully, realizing he had better measurements than anyone else had ever had. And when he looked at things really carefully, he found that, in fact, the sun-centered universe really didn't work if you assumed that the planets were moving on circles. And he found that if he assumed that the planets moved on ellipses, that he could fit the data very, very well. And this is an example of scientific methodology. It's a very early stage. This is a big deal. Because for millennia, people had assumed that the heavenly bodies have to move on a perfect geometric shape, and circles are more perfect than ellipses. So it just, this was a very major, major thing. Kepler actually derived three laws, we call them Kepler's laws, that basically describe the motion of the planets in terms of these ellipses. They're pointless to bring up in this class, and it doesn't really, why I'm even mentioning them, I'll tell you in a moment. But he basically came up with mathematical relationships that described the elliptical motion of the planets in great detail. So they're sort of silly things like a planet will sweep out a certain area in a certain amount of time, depending on where it is, and he got a relationship that actually fit elliptical data really well. So Kepler finally got to where we were quantifying things, and then Isaac Newton came up with his theory of gravity, and he was able to derive from first principles of this idea of gravity in this form, he was able to derive Kepler's three laws. And I don't know, you know, if I had to pick a moment and time to be someone, you know, Newton, when he realized that he just did this, or maybe Maxwell, when he realized that his equations actually describe light, would have to be, you know, two of the most magical moments in humankind's experience. I mean, this is pretty heady stuff to have actually just derived mathematically from these ideas of the forces and everything the actual motion of the planets is a pretty amazing thing and a major accomplishment. Do you have any thoughts or comments on any of this? Okay, so that just sort of lays out a lot of the pieces of the early stages. So what I wanted to do next is to go into, I mean, we don't actually use Newton's law of gravity. We have to use general relativity. So we have to talk a little bit about general relativity and Einstein's work in early 1900s. But since we're sort of talking about man's place in the cosmos, I thought I'd float out some thoughts that are out there that will be sort of tied in thematically with a lot of the stuff we're talking about as we go through different cosmologies. And one of which has come to be called the Copernican principle. And so it basically takes this idea of Copernicus, which was, you know, Earth and humankind should not necessarily be at the center of everything. What's so special about Earth? And so if you generalize this idea, we have what's called the Copernican principle, which is, you know, Earth is not in a central favored position in the universe, as humans do not occupy a privileged position in the universe. And this is actually a core principle in cosmology, that basically any cosmological model or theory we have of the universe, if you were anywhere else in the universe, that universe should look like it does from Earth. I'm not talking about the details of what the star pattern looks like, but basically, you know, the overall density of the stars, the way in which they move, the basic picture of the universe would have to be the same, because otherwise, you know, why are we special? And so this is sort of a generalization of a pretty core idea in science, which is that if you just take a quick snapshot of something, you should assume that you're seeing it in a typical state, that not in a very special state. So this Copernican principle sort of gets generalized into the so-called mediocrity principle, which is there's nothing special about us. So if we observe in a phenomenon, it should be assumed the event occurs in times and places under the correct circumstances. And we're still fighting this, right? If you pick up the newspaper and pay any attention to sort of the science newsy stuff that comes up, I mean, every other week they've got some article about a powerful new telescope that's discovered planets and yet some other star. I mean, I don't even know why that's surprising, but people are excited by it, and it's good. NASA pushes it because they sort of want to justify manned space, but I don't think it should be surprising at all, right? According to the mediocrity principle, I mean, if we assume that we're sort of typical, then there ought to be planets all over the place. We just and now that we're finally developing instruments where we can go and see them, we're actually seeing them. So again, the mediocrity principle is a driving idea behind lots of the cosmology. As we'll talk about in a second, this can be very contentious. So, and it begins sort of here. There's a number of different forms of something which is called the anthropic principle, which comes into play in all of this thinking about different universes, which basically says our universe isn't completely typical, or it has to be unusual to the extent that we are actually here, basically. So it's a little bit of an obvious statement, and it can be said in a very obvious way, or it can be said in a way that's almost fighting words amongst scientists, sort of. So Although our situation is not necessarily central, is inevitably privileged to some extent, basically meaning we are here. So to me, the obvious way to phrase it is, you know, our location in the universe is necessarily privileged to the extent that it's compatible with our actual existence here. Okay? That is what a scientist would call a selection bias. We can only observe it if we can be here. Therefore, that's what we observe. So if you do an experiment where you're only able to observe blue light, you're only going to see things that emit blue light. It's sort of a, well, duh. And if you really want to understand everything, you might have to correct for the fact that your instrument has this bias. I mean, that's something that you do standard in science. Where it starts to get contentious is people have pushed the idea that the universe is effectively designed so that we can be here. So the idea is that the universe must be such as to admit the creation of observers within it at some stage. So when you start getting into the strong anthropic principle, then it is more religious. And some scientists get very upset when you mention the A word. The reason I bring this up is one of the things that's going to pop up as we move through the rest of the class is if we look very carefully at physical constants of nature, the statement, for example, that we are here is a very powerful statement. For us to be here, there has to be carbon, for example. For there to be carbon, you have to have stars exist that can fuse hydrogen to helium and stuff into the carbon. And preferably, they have to be able to exist long enough that things can happen and they can go supernova and spread the stuff all over the place so that it can later condense and you can form life. So that's not a small thing. If I tweak the mass of the neutron a little bit, or if I change the strength of the weak nuclear force or the strong nuclear force a little bit, you can't have stars. If gravity is a little bit stronger, then black holes form so fast you don't get stars creating elements. So if you were to make a catalog of all the basic physical constants of nature, the strengths of the forces, the masses of the particles, and stuff like that, it looks as if we live in a pretty special universe. And people who push intelligent design, this religious idea, look at questions about life, which I'm not really talking about other than the fact that it exists, or these special sort of the details of the physical constants and the fact that they seem pretty carefully chosen or at least sort of fine-tuned in a sense, as evidence that there had to be an intelligent creator designing it, okay? As we talk about multiple universes, these two sort of collide in the sense that what we're going to find is there are scenarios where all the possibilities of different choices of physical constants will get populated in a great multiverse where you have an infinite number of possibilities. And so, of course, we will find ourselves in one where we can exist. So in a sense, the idea in the multiverse, the ideas in the multiverse is that, yeah, any universe you go to is sort of going to have some interesting set of constants, and we have to exist in one of them, and so we happen to be in one of these. All of them get populated. So in that sense, it's not a really bizarre thing that it should happen. Yeah?
Because, like, basically there's so much trial and error that it only makes sense that this situation arises.
Yeah. Yeah, basically you have some set of physical constants and you just are trying every possibility. So you're certainly going to populate one like where we live. And of course, since we live here, we will find ourselves in one like that. So it gets tied a little bit with the anthropic principle in this form, because if you populate them all, we will certainly find ourselves in one where we can exist. So that's basically the statement. But creationism or the intelligent design pushes a little bit more in this. It's basically saying, using the strong form of the anthropic principle, which is saying things are so weird that it had to be designed intelligently, and you know, in fact, it must have been designed to admit us. So, what's interesting is you can. There have been instances where the anthropic principle has been used in a very scientific way. There's an example. Oh boy, I'm going to forget the guy's name. I want to say Hoyle, a famous astronomer, but I might be off on the name. At any rate, basically was realizing how important a certain stage in stellar evolution had to be, and was trying to calculate out the nuclear physics, and realized for this to happen, there needed to be an excited state of a certain isotope of one of the nuclei that had never been discovered. So quite literally predicted the existence of this state that then people went out and found. So by virtue of the fact that we're here and carbon-based, et cetera, meant that this thing had to exist and people went out and found it. That was a very scientific way of sort of using this idea. So so the anthropic principle. Okay, so it got a little... Here's sort of more modern forms of these things. The observed values of all physical and cosmological quantities are not equally probable, but they must take on values restricted by the requirement that there exist sites where carbon-based life can evolve, and by the requirements that the universe be old enough for it to have already done so. There are certain choices of constants that you can do which will actually cause the universe to expand so fast that you cannot form stars, or to basically collapse so fast that it can't be around long enough to form stars. So again, there's a statement here that there's a bound. And then there's this version of the strong anthropic principle, which gives it a bad name in the scientific circles. The universe must have these properties which allow it to develop life within it at some stage in its history. Okay, so generally, scientists in doing cosmologies tend to look at the top version of the weak anthropic principle as a sort of an observational, a selection bias in the system. Yeah, we're here, so therefore that has to be true. And the strong anthropic principle is just a dirty word to most, to scientists. That just doesn't work. You can believe it, but that's not science when you're using that form. Okay, so we're going to sort of come back to this as we go. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
Can you just explain the weak anthropic
principle is actually saying? Okay, so what it's really saying is, by virtue of the fact that we are here, the way the universe is structured has to allow that to happen. I mean, it's sort of an obvious statement, I guess. It's not anything more than that, really. The thing is, if you even allow that to be said, it actually places constraints on many of the physical constants. It sort of puts you in what naively might be funny choices of some of these constants. And so since your mission is to sort of try to figure out where all this crap comes from, that's a relevant thing. So okay. So before we really talk about cosmology straight up, I want to mention the theoretical framework that we actually are using in order to talk about cosmology. And that is the theory of general relativity by Albert Einstein, which was published in around 1916. So I would remind you that in 1905, he published a theory which was the theory of special relativity. And if you recall from earlier in the semester when we talked about the theory of special relativity, the special in special relativity had to do with the constraint that what you're doing is you are relating measurements or observations from one reference frame to another. And those reference frames have to be moving at a constant speed with respect to one another, a constant velocity. And that requirement that they be constant is the thing that he called special. Okay? And so he threw that out for general relativity. And when you throw that out, what it means is that you can have accelerating reference frames. And life is just different if you're in an accelerating reference frame. If you're in an elevator and you press the button and it starts to go up, if you're in a big, tall skyscraper or something, what do you feel?
Yeah. So is this like time dilation?
Yeah, it is.
Wasn't time, that, like, all that wasn't part of special relativity?
Well, it was, but it's not going away.
Okay.
I mean, the essential piece here is that you can now deal with accelerated reference frames. So special relativity is, in a sense, a special case of general relativity. So if you're in an accelerated reference frame, you have lots of weird things happening. If you're in an elevator and it starts going up, you feel heavier. In fact, you did this in a recitation, right? You were able to show that you get heavier or lighter depending on the way in which you're accelerating. So Einstein was an absolute magician at sort of seeing the obvious. So he sees this and he says, well, maybe there's a complete equivalence between gravity and accelerated reference frames. Because if I get in an elevator, I feel it. I feel heavier if it starts going up. Now, so at first blush, I think sounds like a completely crazy idea, but that's sort of the way Einstein was able to see these things. So imagine if you are in an elevator out in the middle of space. Well, imagine you're in an elevator. Imagine you are in a small room with no windows on Earth. Or maybe you're on a rocket ship out in space far away from some gravitating body, but it's accelerating at 1G, which is basically the acceleration of an object toward the center of the Earth. If you have no windows in the thing, how would you ever tell the difference? That's what Einstein basically said. And he used this idea that they have to be equivalent, and he called it the equivalence principle. So he basically said that this and that are completely the same physically in terms of what you can see inside this box. So he equates the accelerated reference frame with the gravitational field. So this difference from special relativity is why general relativity becomes, even though it's really nothing more than a relation of observables from one reference frame to another, it becomes a theory of gravity because you're allowing accelerated reference frames, and he uses this so-called principle of equivalence. So this may sound sort of strange. I mean, I hope it does. It ought to. But it has some real implications. So suppose that we're just in a room on Earth and you send a light beam, you would think that light beam has to go in a straight line. I mean, that's sort of what we think about. If you are on a rocket ship that is accelerating at 1G, right? So what that means is that it's going faster and faster with time as it goes up. And suppose that you're in a room on the rocket ship and you have a laser that sends out a very quick pulse of light, okay, toward that wall. Now think about it. The light moves at a finite speed. So as the light is moving the rocket ship is accelerating this way. So the light is going to appear to be going toward the floor. And as the rocket ship continues to accelerate, it's going faster and faster, that light is going to curve more and more toward the floor. So by virtue of the light moving in this reference frame where it's basically being accelerated around it, the light on the rocket ship as it crosses the room basically has to go in a curve like that. And then Einstein says, if the equivalence principle is true, then the same sort of thing has to happen for light in a gravitational field, because I've equated the two. So Einstein says that even on Earth, it happens, but it happens because the gravitational field is so weak you can't see it. Basically, though, that light is traveling on a curved path. Yeah.
So what's 1G?
One G is a measure of, it's 9.8 meters per second. So if you were to calculate the acceleration of a ball if you drop it at the surface of the Earth, it accelerates at 1G. So a way to think about it is your mass times 1G is basically the force that you feel on your feet. So if you're measuring things like forces due to acceleration, you measure them in quantities of G. So 1G is what you would feel on Earth. If you were on an elevator that was pushing up really fast such that you felt twice as heavy, if that elevator would be accelerating at 2G. If you're in an F-15, they talk about the number of G-forces that you go in certain maneuvers, because at a certain number of Gs, the blood will drain from your head and you'll lose consciousness.
So they're just accelerating at 9.8 meters per second?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. 9.8 meters per second squared. So, so if you were here and you dropped the ball, it would go toward the floor exactly like it does here on Earth. That would be the deal. So this is now a pretty strange thing, because what Einstein has just said is that, look, light, we know, goes in a straight line. But the thing is, if this is equivalent to that, what it means is that gravity effectively bends the straight lines. In other words, gravity curves space. And since we know time and space are mixed up, gravity will actually warp both space and time. So now that's starting to be a big stretch, okay? And it turns out that when you dig into it, the geometry that you and I learned to love or hate in high school is called Euclidean geometry. And in Euclidean geometry, it's a geometry where the lines are straight. And two lines that are parallel go straight and will go forever without meeting, okay? It turns out that that's only a special case, that if you go over to the math department, they have entire courses on different types of geometry where you can actually have curved geometries. So they call it differential geometry. So the mathematics gets rather nasty. But Einstein basically interpreted gravitation as a curvature of space and time, and then had to go and figure out how to do the math to basically do his theory. And so he did, but that's why it took him over 10 years to develop the theory, because the math is painful. So he interprets gravitation as a curvature of space-time. So the picture that you get sort of is space and time are more like a fabric in this picture than they are like this immutable abstract quantities. You sort of think of it as something that can be distorted. So you can almost imagine the gravitational field of Earth as being sort of this warping in space and time, such that things that are moving get attracted toward the Earth. So this would be sort of a two-dimensional picture of what he's saying is happening in full three dimensions in space-time, or four.
This is all because of the acceleration because of the gravity.
Yeah, I mean, somehow he took this idea, which we all experience, and he just generalized it and then pursued it. So he sort of did the same thing with special relativity, where he took the step that people were a little reluctant to take, and he just said, well, the speed of light is the same for everybody.
So would light look different on a different planet, you know, smaller planet?
Yeah, well, yeah, things get different at different heights. I mean, what you find, there's a prediction that if you were to, say, take light and send it up, for example, its color changes as it goes up. It's called a gravitational redshift, and this is predicted by general relativity. So it basically has to fight its way out of this so-called gravitational well. Clocks.
It's like refracting.
It's more of an energy loss thing, I guess. Clocks move at different speeds, and they move slower in large gravitational fields. So if you take two clocks and you put one on a satellite that goes way out into space, it's going to actually run faster than the one you left on Earth. And this now is an essential correction that has to be done for the GPS system, because you have satellites out there. The whole thing runs basically via accurate clocks. So the fact that the GPS system works means you have to correct for the fact that time moves at different rates at different heights. Again, as in special relativity, the effect is really small for any usual things. You don't need to adjust your watch when you go up in the mountains or something. I mean, gravitational force is not all that different. But when you start getting far away from Earth, and when you're demanding very high precision in the timing, like you need for the global positioning system, you actually have to take into account this distortion of space-time caused by gravitation. Yeah.
What happens to space-time in a black hole?
Okay, we'll get there. I mean, what's happening there is basically the distortion is so bad it's just curved back in on itself. So if you send a light beam in a black hole, the light literally never escapes. So it's as if you get the condition for a black hole when even light goes into orbit, that it's always being, okay? And if you are outside of a black hole and you were sending a clock into a black hole, you would perceive time stopping as the clock reached the point where the light basically goes in. You would never actually see the clock go into the black hole. If you were riding the clock, you would never notice that. But from outside, time appears to stop. It's a very bizarre sort of thing.
It's because it's so dense relative to its size.
Yeah, the gravitational field strength is so strong that, yeah.
So then, when we look at black holes in telescopes, do we see like halos from all the light that hit the event horizon?
Close. We quite literally cannot see the black hole, because light from the black hole can't get to us. But the events surrounding the black hole can be quite amazingly chaotic and crazy. So, for example, I talk about riding a clock into a black hole, but you just can't do that. And the reason is there's something called tidal forces. So if you think about it, here on Earth, we're sort of on this large body. The center that the forces are going down to is really way, way far away. And here we are. And the force on this toe might be going that way. The force on this toe might be going that way, slightly in toward the center. But it's not that big a deal. If you have a black hole, on the other hand, there's massive gravitational force, and the thing is very compact, so that basically you have your forces are squeezing you together there, and the force that is on your toes is massively stronger than the force that's on your head, because gravity basically grows as 1 over r squared. So as you're getting very close and the force is so great, the force on the toes are much greater. So what happens is whatever matter approaches a black hole, it gets compressed this way and stretched that way and basically ripped to smithereens. So matter can't survive going into a black hole. So what happens is if you have matter spiraling into a black hole, it effectively gets destroyed, and it can emit X-rays and things in the process. And so those X-ray signals you can actually see. So if you have a double star system, which I think is not unusual in the universe, although we don't happen, I mean, we almost have one. I mean, Jupiter almost made it to be a star, but didn't quite. If it were a bit bigger, then you would actually have had fusion reactions in Jupiter, and we'd have a second sun. And I don't know what that would have meant for our chances, but if you have a binary star system, it can happen that you'll get a black hole for one of them, and it'll basically slowly pull matter off the orbiting star, and that matter then can spiral in and give you a signal that's actually rather distinct, and people see it. So black holes have been indirectly observed, but of course you can't actually see. Yeah.
Wouldn't there be kind of like, I don't know, if there's that much pressure on matter as it's going in, especially if you have like, I don't know, a sun being like, or a star being pulled in, wouldn't like crazy things be created within a black hole because of the pressure in the fusion? Because you'd never be able to see it.
Well, we can't see it, but yeah, basically there's nothing to stop the collapse. So all the stuff that goes into it effectively goes into a singularity, in a sense. Now, that's a problem, because when you take a finite amount of stuff and you put it in an infinitesimally small point, all the numbers go wacko. You basically have infinite density, everything, and so all your equations go completely nuts. So probably that doesn't happen. We believe that you will get quantum effects that will happen, and we're going to see one multiverse which tries to take advantage of this. In fact, maybe I should just mention it now, since it's sort of natural in our conversation. So we really don't know what happens in there, but what we do know is that recall that that we had the idea that a particle of mass has a wavelength, and if we have a particle, if we have a finite amount of mass, and we compress it into a small enough point, even if it's a small amount of mass, if you compress it to a small enough point, you'll actually form effectively a black hole. I mean, it doesn't have to be something the size of a star. The issue is you can't take things and compress them to be that small. Generally. But if you calculate the quantum mechanical wavelength of an object, there comes a mass where if you have it in a small enough area, the size of the black hole, which is called a Schwarzschild radius, which is basically the radius at which the gravitational field is so strong light would go into orbit. If the Schwarzschild radius is about the same size as the quantum mechanical wavelength, then what it's saying is that the distortions in space-time due to gravity have to be rivaled by quantum mechanical effects. And in that regime, the theory of gravity can't work. Einstein's stuff can't really work. You have to have what's called quantum gravity. And we don't have a theory of quantum gravity yet.
Can you kind of go into more depth with that?
Yeah, sorry. I probably already went into too much. Maybe I can do a better job just trying to paint it a little bit further out here. When you get really strong gravitational fields or extraordinarily high energies, and you look at the gravitational effects between things, you have to start taking into account quantum mechanics, basically. And this idea of distortion of space and time is a very smooth thing. But if we were able to probe space and time on a smaller and smaller distance scale, which is sort of a way of saying going to very, very high energies, we would see that space and time are anything but smooth. So there's a guy named John Wheeler who says that you can think of the structure of space-time as like the ocean. If you're up in an ocean liner and you're looking at it from far away, you see it as very smooth. And then as you get very, very, very close to it, you see that basically it's this seething foam of stuff with lots of structure and everything. So he actually looks at the space-time in our universe the same way as that. In general relativity, you are sort of very far away, relatively low energies and everything, and you're looking at the structure of space-time from far away, and it's very smooth. That's the world in which we live. But if you go up to very high energies, or if you're, say, inside a black hole and forcing everything to small spaces, all of a sudden the structure of the space-time becomes very important and very dynamic. And in order to really understand it, you have to have a theory equipped to deal with sort of the the structure or the quantum changes, the way that space and time can change at very small scales. So what led me off into that is that in order to understand what's happening inside a black hole, you probably need a quantum theory of gravity, because everything will get compressed to basically a point. And so there is one type of multiverse which is actually sort of fun. It's by a guy named Lee Smolin. And I call it the Feakin multiverse. Oops, but I can't spell multiverse. So Lee has this idea that space collapsing inside a black hole basically undergoes a bounce and rebounds. I guess I am. Now that I think about it, this is a little bit premature. We're about to make the case today or in the next class that we live in an expanding universe, that the space-time is actually expanding. What we find is that when you take the equations of general relativity and you try to basically create a universe, they're unstable. So the space-time actually has to expand or contract. I mean, it's doing one of these. His idea is that you have this collapsing space-time inside a black hole when the black hole is formed, and it will continue to collapse almost to a point, and then it will actually rebound. The actual mechanism of the rebound is fuzzy because we don't have a theory of quantum gravity. He has sort of hand-waving ways of working around this, but basically if you assume it now rebounds, you have this interesting situation where he can cobble up a space-time within the black hole that looks just like our expanding universe would look. And it's causally disconnected from us, because once the black hole forms, light signals can't go back and forth. So whatever happens inside the black hole is totally separated from the universe that created it. So he basically has this idea that universes are born, they're like ships in a bottle. You have universes that are born inside of black holes. Yeah.
How big is a black hole? I mean, that's maybe a ridiculous question.
No, it's not actually, because it depends on how much mass it is that starts it. So if I have a little bit of mass and I'm able to compress it into a small enough region, it will form a black hole. But basically, the gravitational field will only be so strong that light has to orbit it fairly close in. If I have much more mass, I will have a much bigger black hole because the gravitational field is that strong further out.
So what about I don't know, I guess our universe makes it so that it's definitely not a black hole?
Well, the according to Smolin's theory, you actually can't tell,
okay.
Right? I mean, as weird as it seems, you might think, how can our universe be inside this thing? But we're causally disconnected. So once you go into that threshold, they basically become separate beasts. Yeah.
So adding more mass.
It just creates a bigger black hole. So, in fact, people believe, we have evidence for active galactic nuclei. So in some galaxies, there's strong evidence that there are massive black holes at the center of the galaxy that are actually crushing lots of stuff and sending out massive amounts of energy.
And we haven't found anything for the evolution after a black hole. Black holes ever, re-implode or whatever? Explode or do anything of that sort?
In general, the answer is no, but no, we have not seen such a thing. Yes, Stephen Hawking is famous because he discovered that black holes can actually evaporate. There's a quantum process that causes black holes to actually emit a little bit of energy. And I'm going to avoid that right now, but there is a process that... So actually, it turns out really tiny black holes will actually evaporate, and the bigger ones will eventually evaporate, but the smaller they are, the faster they're going. And this is basically due to a quantum process, and we've talked about the pair production of electrons and positrons in the vacuum. So around the black hole, if you have a pair-produced quantum process basically creating these virtual particles, and one of them gets sucked into the black hole, you have this other one that's actually free to emit, and it's a way of actually evaporating energy from the black hole. It's called Hawking radiation, and so he's famous for his books and being some interesting guy, but as a physicist, that's one of the reasons he's famous as a physicist. Okay, so let me paint this picture since I sort of jumped into it. So if you'll allow me this idea that inside a black hole, space collapses and then something causes it to start expanding again, then you can actually create a space-time within the black hole that, for all intents and purposes, would look like the space-time that we basically see in our universe today. And if you were to just sort of grant that for a minute, you have a very interesting set of consequences that come out of that. Because basically, when we talked about the anthropic principle, and I mentioned that that we have to have a universe where life can exist, it means we have to be able to have stars, and the stars have to exist for a long time. This is something you have to have for black holes. So in all this range of physical constants that you can have, not all of them would actually have a universe where you could ever create a black hole. Okay? So if we had a multiverse where different universes are formed through some mechanism that, we're actually going to talk about a lot of different mechanisms as we go, but just grant me for instance that we have a way of creating universes, perhaps physically separated in space, where the physical constants are actually different. Eventually, you're going to get one where you have physical constants where you can form a black hole. What he says is that when the space collapses in the black hole and then does a rebound, the physical constants change a tiny bit during this quantum processes that happen. Things will jiggle a little bit as it rebounds. But the physical constants of the born universe will be very similar to the one that created it. So now you have exactly the sort of situation that we have biologically with natural selection. So what he says is if you create a universe that can create a black hole, it will create a universe that will create a black hole. And the constants will vary a little bit. So eventually you'll create a universe that's a little more optimal for black hole production. And if that's true, it will create universes that share that characteristic that are a little bit more optimal for black hole production. So basically what he says is in the sum total of all the possible universes that might exist, once you create one that can create a black hole, it will give birth to those that create that are more optimal for black hole production, and eventually you will have nothing but universes that are optimal for black hole production. So what he says is using the Copernican principle, or the principle of mediocrity, our universe cannot be unusual. And so he then makes actually a very specific scientific statement, which is our universe must be optimal for black hole production. And he calls this idea cosmological natural selection. And he makes a big deal about it because we're about to talk about a whole series of multiverses, and there isn't a single one where I can step outside into the great reality and say, ah, there's a universe, here's another universe, and compare their characteristics and prove to you that we live in a multiverse. So what Smolin says is all this multiverse crap is just metaphysics. It's philosophy because you can't actually make a measurement. And most of the ideas do not have any observable, any idea of something that you can go out and make an observation and falsify them. So he says they're not that different from religion or philosophy. So the idea of the Thecan multiverse he's into because he says it makes a hypothesis that is falsifiable. You can go out and look at all the physical constants in our universe, and if you understand enough about how black holes are produced, you should be able to find that we live in a universe that's very close to optimal for black hole production. That's what his theory actually states. And if you found that our universe is very different than optimal for black hole production, it falsifies his theory. I mean, then it's just wrong. So that's his idea. So that's one of the crazy multiverse ideas. I can't talk and draw pictures very well at the same time on this, so I'll have to make a slide up that describes it. Any comments or thoughts about that? Hopefully some of this will make a little more sense as we move into more of the conventional Big Bang and expanding universe stuff, but yeah.
Would matter that goes into one of these Thecan multiverses, would that be kind of like how would that translate into the universe in the black hole?
You might worry about energy conservation and things like that, since a finite amount of stuff goes in. I think there's a way around that, but let me put that off for a couple of lectures because we're going to talk about a mechanism for effectively creating something out of effectively nothing as a quantum thing. Yeah.
I guess I'm wondering how do we know that there's anything but black holes?
We don't. I mean, in his theory, we're inside a black hole. And our black holes are giving birth to universes.
And there are black holes inside the black hole.
Yeah. And ad infinitum.
Yeah.
That's that picture. It's pretty bizarre. But the cool thing is, it's at least one multiverse theory that actually gives an observable consequence. Although,
is it observable though?
Well, yeah. I mean, people in principle can look at can argue whether or not our universe is optimal for black hole production, and I don't know how many people really struggled with that, but at least I have a quote. I think it's in the book, probably some later chapter than the one we're up to. Where some famous astronomer, quite influential, just says, well, that's just crap, and gives some arguments as to why it's not. And others say, well, it's really an open question. So, but it is something you can actually think about. Yeah?
If you have a black hole, inside the black hole, if you do believe that we're just creating black holes inside a black hole, and that in each of those black holes is the universe, how is your universe smaller.
Right. So that, yeah. So you have to worry about energy conservation and stuff. So. I think you can get around that one because we're totally causally disconnected. So it's not like that other universe that comes blasting out of the black hole. Let me look and see if I can find a nice pictogram. There's a way of looking at it in a pictogram that sort of makes it make sense. But basically, we're cut off from that space-time once the black hole forms. And so whatever happens inside there, we would never know. It's a little bit strange, but it's... Okay, it's a lot strange. But I think it can happen because of the causal disconnectedness. All right, so that was a bit of a tangent, sorry. If we just go back to plain old general relativity and the fact that you think of space-time as being curved, there are... observable consequences. It turns out that it's hard to do precision tests of general relativity because the effects are fairly small. You need large masses or large distances and things, so it's not so easy. But there was a very nice bit of work done, I think, in about 1931 by a guy named Eddington, and it's been repeated many times. But the idea is if light is bent by a gravitational object like the sun, then in a you could imagine how in a total eclipse you could look at the positions of stars, and if light, say, is coming from this star, is bent as it goes around the sun, then the light that we would see would have to take a path something like this. And if we then extrapolate this line, so from our line of sight, where we would appear to see the star is over here. And if you think about the position of this star relative to the far distant background of other stars out here, close to the sun, you would actually see a measurable shift in the positions, the apparent positions of the stars due to this distortion of the light. And this was observed and agreed exactly with general relativity. Yeah.
So if you saw this, this picture, like it appeared to be in one place that it wasn't,
yeah,
you got on like a rocket ship and went in a straight line, and you went in a straight line at where you saw the star,
right,
would you end up at the star?
No.
You would, okay, but you would curve most of the time.
Well, okay. I mean, you being in your rocket ship, you can keep going in a straight line if you try. I mean, you might have to, yeah.
So if
we shot light back this way, then it would be bent here and be headed toward the star. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it will. We're going to get to dark matter soon.
I mean, I know we've been talking a lot about black holes today. Is that any, I'm just wondering, is there any place that antimatter has in that discussion?
Antimatter, in a sense, is nothing special in our universe. I mean, it just, if I have enough energy and it converts into matter, it'll convert into particles and antiparticles. And there is a big question that we do not understand as to why the universe is matter instead of antimatter. So in the details of the particle physics, which we don't even yet understand, we believe there's a bias in there somewhere that's built in, but we don't understand it. I probably won't talk a lot about that. We're going to end up at an early, as we start talking about early stages of our universe or any of these universes, as where the energy density is very high, you're basically going to have a seething mass of particles and antiparticles, and there may be an underlying mechanism that leads it to be predominantly particles rather than antiparticles after a while. But I'm not going to talk a whole lot about antimatter. We will talk a bit about dark matter. soon. So, sorry if it seems so disjoint. There's another way of relativity comes into play. If you have light undergoing this kind of thing, you could actually imagine having light from some distant object get bent so that you see this light from the same object approaching Earth from different directions. And this is called gravitational lensing. It actually will act like a literal magnifying glass, or, you know, bending the light. And here's an example of a single object where we're actually seeing different images of the same thing, because there's a massive object sort of between us and the distant bright object. So people actually use gravitational lensing these days to study matter in the universe that we can't actually see. So it's now being used as a tool. There are other observable consequences. One thing that if you were to take Newtonian gravity, and as I say, Newton figured out the puzzle to planetary motion, it turned out that when that actually he almost did. If you compare observations with Newtonian predictions, there was one thing that was not understood, which is Mercury's orbit sort of slowly swings around. There's a position of closest approach in an ellipse to the sun, which is called the perihelion. And this ellipse sort of slowly swings around with time. And if you looked at how the perihelion, that point of closest approach, sort of moves around the sun as all of these different orbits happen, Newtonian physics actually gets it wrong. And general relativity gets it exactly right. So again, these are sort of subtle things, but that's what you look for. So Newtonian physics actually fits an awful lot of the stuff that we do, but general relativity actually is our accepted correct theory of gravitation. If you think of space and time as being a fabric, then if you have, say, for example, two massive objects like black holes or massive stars orbiting each other very fast, then you can imagine the gravitational strength, field strength in this space-time is actually going to be changing with time. And according to general relativity, if you think of space and time as basically a fabric, that the curvature is a measure of the field strength, of the gravitational field, then, in fact, you can think of the space-time as a fabric, and things like orbiting masses are going to cause ripples in that fabric, which will propagate out. And we call them gravitational waves, and they are a very clear prediction of general relativity that has yet to be observed. And they have yet to be observed because, basically, the further away you are from an object that's doing something like this, the smaller the amplitude of the wiggles in the fabric. So it's just like if you throw a stone in a pond, right where it hits, you have sort of a big amplitude, but basically that amplitude gets smaller and smaller as the wave gets further and further out. So fortunately, we don't have really close by massive objects moving around and collapsing. So it turns out that the gravitational waves that we sort of expect to be seen from things in our galaxy are mostly very small. So in fact, like distortions sort of on the size of atomic nuclei or something, which are really, really hard to see. There are instruments being built, there are instruments that are actually looking for them right now. Even distortions that small, you can look for if you have an idea of what the pattern will be. So people actually believe that gravitational waves probably do exist and are trying to find them. And if we actually develop instruments that are capable of seeing these types of distortions, then we may be able to do astronomy, in a sense, by measuring gravitational waves. Instead of looking at light, we can actually look at how things are wiggling out there and understand astronomical events by the way the masses are moving, which is a totally different way of looking at things. Any questions about general relativity? So that's about all I was going to say about general relativity per se. But this is now, the equations of general relativity are the equations that we use to understand the large-scale structure of our universe. So the next topic is to actually jump into why, what is our model of the evolution and origin of the universe, which is what I call cosmology, which is not cosmetology. I just want to point that out because they do get confused sometimes, but they are actually rather different. And there are links here if you are interested in learning more about the difference between cosmology and cosmetology. And I do find that typical parties, people also do very much get astronomy and astrology confused. They are actually very, very different in terms of... So be sensitive to these issues. And I guess that's a good place to stop for right now. So we'll jump into the evidence for the hot Big Bang theory of the universe next time. Yes? It is the order they were discovered, but there is also a big difference between the two. Special demands no accelerating reference frame, so gravity doesn't come into play. You don't have this sort of bending of space and time. We do have time dilation and space contraction, but we don't get the warping. So it's a very different sort of theory. You know, that's a good question. I'm not actually sure. I know after the fact it was clear that it was general because it... But I don't know whether Einstein called it the special theory of relativity initially, knowing that that was the constraint that he was putting in, or not. I think it was called general relativity because at that point the difference was important. So, I don't know. That's a good question. I'm curious about that.
Einstein was responsible for both of them.